I'd studied Bentham as a founding father of English utilitarianism, but I'd never come across a little footnote that he wrote in one of his works, which congratulates the French on recognizing that the color of a man's skin is no reason for denying them rights, and then goes on to say, maybe one day we'll recognize that whether a being has fur or a tail is also no reason for denying them rights.
If you've ever been surprised by your own thoughts, well, you're not alone. From the time we're born to the time we die, we spend our lives meeting strangers, including the one within. We also spend our lives learning about many of those strangers and turning them into colleagues, friends, and family. In this podcast, host Charlie Bressler talks with fascinating people on their musings about family, community, work, helping others, and getting to know the stranger inside ourselves. Where do we fit in the world we all inhabit together? Charlie Bressler, the co-founder of The Life You Can Save and former president of a large international retail company, investigates ideas that he has been musing on since he obtained his PhD in clinical and social psychology way back in 1984.
Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for joining me today on Musings About Ourselves and Other Strangers. We know each other quite well. For the audience that may not know, Peter and I started working together over 10 years ago after I wrote him an email about his book, The Life You Can Save. We'll get into that later, perhaps. But Peter, I'd really like to start with you talking a little bit about your early childhood, your family background, and in early influences on you before you ever arrived at Oxford, because I think a lot of people are much more familiar with your history at Oxford and what happened, which I'll ask you about. But I'd really like to hear about your early influences in your family.
I think people hear more about Oxford because it's more of a straight line from there. And it's not at all clear that the early influences on me, or it's not clear in what way they led to what I do and think now.
Well, remember, you're talking to a psychologist, so we always want to find out about people's early life.
How about my toilet training? Do you need to find out about that?
No. I'm not neo-analytic, and I'm not that type of psychologist, but I just happen to be interested in what happens to people before, particularly before they become quite
okay.
Well-known.
All right. So my parents were Jewish people who were living in Vienna. They were not religious, but for the Nazis, they were obviously Jews. And once the Nazis came to Austria in 1938, they soon realized that they didn't have much of a future there. They never dreamt that they would be murdered if they remained there. My father was trying to make a start in business, and there was a law that Jews could not own any businesses. My mother was just qualified as a medical doctor, and there was a law that Jewish doctors could only treat Jewish patients, which was a problem since about a third of the doctors in Vienna were Jewish and maybe 10% of the population. They realized that they needed to leave. They were fortunate in that a rather casual acquaintance, an Australian who'd come to Austria for skiing and had met my mother, and incidentally was an Irish Catholic, or an Australian of Irish Catholic descent, was willing to sponsor them to come to Australia. So they came here, and my sister was born fairly soon after they arrived in 1940, and I was born just after the war in 1946. So I grew up with immigrant parents, keen to assimilate into Australian society. And at first we were not at all well off, but eventually my father was in the coffee business. And when he came to Australia, he was told, you can't make a living in coffee. Australians don't drink coffee. We drink tea here. We're like British people. But fortunately, Italians started coming in the 50s, and then he was able to have a reasonably successful small business. So we became comfortably off after a few years. I went to school in Melbourne. I think I got a reasonably good education. And as I say, my parents were not religious, and I was not religious. I didn't, for example, have a bar mitzvah, which was pretty unusual among Jewish people, even if they were not very religious.
Gosh, even I had a bar mitzvah.
When I went through high school, I did pretty well. And my sister, who, as I mentioned, was quite a few years older than me, had gone to university and studied law. And that seemed like an interesting thing to do. A lot of people had told me that I could be a good lawyer because I love to argue about things. So I applied to Melbourne University to study law. In Australia, you do that straight out of high school. It's an undergraduate degree, as in England. And I was accepted. But when I got there, I saw a counselor. I think it was pretty just standard that, you know, if you were starting a law degree, you saw a counselor who asked you about your interests. And he noticed that I'd done well in subjects like history and languages and literature. And he said, you might find law a little bit dry. You could do a combined arts law degree. And then it would take you 2 years longer if you do an honors arts degree. But you would end up with both degrees and you would find it more interesting. So I did that. That left the question of what would I major in arts. And one of the things I wanted to do was history, because I had always enjoyed that at high school. But my sister had a boyfriend, subsequently became her husband, who had done some philosophy at university and had talked to me about it. And that sounded interesting as well. I didn't know much about it. I'd never studied it. There was no philosophy taught in high schools then. But I decided to do that. And obviously, that was a really important decision to make because I enjoyed it. I did well in it. And at the end of the arts degree, which was, I still would have had another 2 years to finish the law degree, I was offered a scholarship to do a master's degree at the University of Melbourne, which I took, postponing, as I thought, the law degree. I went, talked to the law faculty, and they said, yes, not a problem. You can postpone and come back and finish your law degree later. But I never did. So I was interested particularly in ethics and political philosophy. And I wrote my master's thesis on the topic, why should I be moral? In other words, you know, why act ethically? And I have to say, I did not find a totally convincing argument at the time I wrote the thesis, but it was a successful thesis, and I was then offered a scholarship to go to Oxford. So that's the influences, I suppose, up to the time I got to Oxford.
Well, it may not be as linear as your time at Oxford, which we can get to, but I do want to get into one aspect of it and have you go back in time. I believe the book you wrote about your grandfather was called Pushing Time Away, which I actually read, and so did my daughter. I don't know how often you speak about that book, but could you talk a little bit about that trip to Europe and what you saw and why you wrote the book?
Right. Okay. So as I said, my parents came to Australia in 1938 as refugees. Their parents did not leave at that time. Once my parents got here, there's a lot of letters that were exchanged between my parents and their parents, and they tried to persuade their parents to come. They got visas for their parents to come. Their parents were a little bit slow, a little bit reluctant, for worries that now seem absurd to us, given that we know what happened to them. My mother's father, for example, was a teacher of Greek and Latin and had a large library of classical literature. And wondered whether he would be able to take that to Australia and how he could do that. And also, you know, given that he was German speaking, whether he would be able to do any work, teach or anything like that in Australia. And that was one reason why he procrastinated. But there were other reasons as well. In the end, neither my father's nor my mother's parents left. And the only one of those four who survived was my mother's mother. And she came to Australia in 1946 when I was born. She was the only grandparent I knew, but I knew a little about them. There were photos of them that we had. Obviously, my parents were very sad, particularly my father, who lost both his parents. I knew a little bit about them, but the one that I guess I heard most about, and I was in a way most interested, was my mother's father, the one who was the teacher of Greek and Latin. David Oppenheim is his name. He wasn't just a teacher or a scholar of Greek and Latin. He was interested in psychology and human nature. And because of his interest in human nature and psychology, he attended some lectures that were given at the University of Vienna by a then little-known person called Sigmund Freud. And there were only, I think, about a dozen or so people attending this series of early lectures by Freud. After he'd been to those lectures, he wrote a letter to Freud suggesting that maybe psychoanalysis could shed some light on classical myths and folk tales. And Freud responded very positively to that letter and said, yes, he'd thought the same sort of thing himself, but he didn't have the scholarly background and knowledge to really develop that theme. and Wood Professor Oppenheim, high school teachers were called professor in Austria, Wood Professor Oppenheim liked to come and meet with him, and they could discuss the possibility of doing this project. My grandfather did go to Freud. They decided to work together on this project, and Freud invited my grandfather to be part of the Wednesday Circle, a group of people who met in his apartment on Wednesday evenings. And there are minutes of those meetings, and my grandfather read a couple of papers to that group. And during that time, they worked on a draft of the paper in which my grandfather provided the sort of raw material, which was actually folk tales rather than myths in this work. And Freud analyzed them from a psychoanalytic perspective. But then the split occurred between Freud and Adler, who was probably the most prominent member, other than Freud, of course, of the Wednesday Circle. And my grandfather thought that Freud had behaved in a despicably authoritarian manner towards Adler, not tolerating any dissent from his own views, and sided with Adler. And anybody who sided with Adler in that dispute, Freud never spoke to them again. But the paper that they were working on survived. It was obviously in my grandfather's possession. And rather miraculously, it survived the war. My grandfather must have given it to one of his non-Jewish friends. And then because my grandmother survived, she retrieved the things that were given to this friend. And she brought it out to Australia. So I knew about this connection with Freud. I also knew that he'd written other things from an Adlerian perspective, because he was a member of the Society for Individual Psychology, which was the Adlerian Society. And so he was something of a scholar, and I guess to some extent I identified with that. Obviously, I'm interested in exploring things about human nature as well. And also because there were both his published writings and the letters that I mentioned, there was quite a lot of material to learn more about him. In the 1990s, I thought, if I'm ever going to do this, I should do it. I was in my 50s by then. And so I started reading some of this stuff. It's in German, so I read it much more slowly than I would read English, and decided that there was enough materials to write a book about my grandfather, focusing mostly on my grandfather, but also on the whole story of their lives in Vienna, and based on the letters, the rather agonizing story of their delays and procrastinations, which led to the deaths of three of them, and pretty horrible years during the war for the one, my grandmother's, who survived. So that's why I put that book together. I know you're asking about influences on me, so I expect you would want to know, and your listeners would want to know, what influence do I think this background had on my future views? And it's pretty hard to say, you know, how it connects specifically with the views that I hold. Obviously, it led to an abhorrence of racism. It led to an abhorrence of authoritarian regimes. It led perhaps to an emphasis on the idea of trying to reason together in civil manner and avoid the deterioration of public discourse that occurred in Weimar Germany and a number of other countries in Europe in the 30s, 20s and 30s. As I mentioned, I was very interested in history, and my principal interest in history was in 20th century European history. And how was it possible for what seemed like a civilized society to develop those fascist and Nazi regimes? So it had all of those influences. Did it have any influence on my views about animals? I doubt it. It's hard to trace that. Did it have an influence on my views about our obligations to help people in extreme poverty? Again, it's difficult to see that because my parents didn't have those views to any greater extent than most people would. That is, you know, yes, they gave quite small amounts to charity and not particularly to charity helping complete strangers. They gave to some Jewish charities to help Jewish people in need, but they were not looking to say, who are the worst off people, where we can do the most good.
Well, it's a fascinating book for me because I'm interested in some of the same things you were interested in that led you to look into your grandfather's past. And I was particularly interested in what happened in Weimar Germany and the authoritarian movements in Russia and in Germany. and Adler, for that matter. I don't know whether you ever got interested in Adler's views or the role of insecurity in people's psychology. But anyway, I think that if I had had to be there then, I would have been like your grandfather, had become more of an Adlerian than a Freudian, yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, I actually, you know, my mother and my aunt, my mother had a sister also came to Australia. They were both somewhat interested in Adler because of their father's connection. My aunt more than my mother, probably. And there was also a cousin who was actually really considered herself an Adlerian and tried to establish a society for individual psychology in Melbourne. I don't think it ever got more than a dozen or so members and supporters. But I certainly knew about that. And I tend to agree with you to some extent that, you know, whereas Freud was trying to explain basically everything in terms of suppressed sexual desires, Adler wanted to say no, things like insecurity and the inferiority complex, which was the term that he developed, are really important, and therefore the sense of inferiority and conversely the sense of power really make a difference to human nature. That seems to me true, and I think Freud was trying to defend a one-sided view of what our unconscious motivations are.
Maybe it would be good for those people in the audience who may not know what you did at Oxford, the two movements that you became very influential in, before we move on, to explain that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So I went to Oxford to do a graduate degree in philosophy. I enjoyed Oxford a lot. The people who we had been reading as undergraduates and during my master's at Melbourne, a number of them were there at Oxford. It was definitely at that time, I went there in 69, it was the philosophical center of the English-speaking world. Probably the most momentous experience that I had was one that was entirely accidental. That is that after one of the classes, I had asked a question in that class, and a Canadian graduate student came up to me and said, "What did you think of the answer to your question?" And I said, "I didn't think really it had fully answered the question." And he said, "I agree." And then we started talking about this. Was the question was something to do with freedom and responsibility, like freedom in the sense of free will. So we were getting into a conversation. It was, 12 or something like that. So he said, "Do you want to come to my college for lunch? And we could continue talking." So I said, "Fine." We went to, he's a student at Balliol College. We went there for lunch. The lunch at that time, he walked into the dining hall, and there was one hot dish that was available for you. If you didn't want the hot dish, you could take a cold salad plate, some lettuce and piece of cheese or something like that. So my friend, Richard Keshen, his name was, I wasn't really a friend at this time, I'd only just met him, asked if there was meat in the hot dish because it had a kind of nondescript brown sauce on it. You couldn't tell whether there was meat in it.
English cooking in the late 60s.
Especially in a college, which is, you know, yeah, cooking for 300 people or something. Yeah, it was not great. So he was told, yes, there was meat in the sauce. And he took the salad plate. So I took the hot dish and we sat down and ate. We continued the conversation about freedom and free will. But eventually that, you know, more or less we our positions were clear. And so I changed the topic by saying, "What's your problem with meat?" Now, again, this is a bit hard to think. In 1969, here I was, I'd been an undergraduate. I'd had a year and a half doing a master's at the University of Melbourne. I'd come to Oxford. I'd been in Oxford for about a year at that stage. I had never met a vegetarian, never met anybody I knew was vegetarian to talk to about that. They just hardly were any. If I'd had to guess what his answer would be, I probably would have first guessed that he thought it was bad for his health. And my second guess might have been that he was a pacifist who thought that killing is just absolutely wrong and that applies to animals. I'd heard of those positions, but as I say, not really talked to anyone who held them. But he simply said, "I don't think it's right for animals to be treated as we treat them, to turn them into meat." And I was surprised by that because I assumed that the animals I was eating were leading reasonably good lives outside in the fields. Of course, I knew that then one day they would get trucked to slaughter. I knew that wasn't going to be a good day, but I thought, well, it's just one day in a pleasant life. But he told me that a lot of the animals were now being reared indoors in very crowded conditions. There was no thought being given to their well-being or to what extent the conditions met their welfare needs. but it was all geared towards producing the product for the lowest possible cost. I'd always thought cruelty to animals was wrong. Most people do, right? But I had thought cruelty to animals means like hitting a dog with a stick or something of that sort. I was surprised by this and somewhat disturbed. And he said there was a book about it. There was one book about it by Ruth Harrison called Animal Machines. Not well known at all, but he knew about it. And it was actually it was about factory farming and the growth of this putting animals indoors. And it was very compelling because it quoted from the farming magazines themselves, telling farmers how to be more productive and, you know, included quotes from these farming magazines saying things like, you know, treat the hen like a well-oiled machine with an output of eggs and the input of food. And what you have to do is to get the biggest output for the least cost of input. So I became concerned about this, and that started me thinking about, well, what is it that entitles us to use animals as I, you know, assumed we were entitled to use them? I looked at some philosophical writings. There were really no contemporary philosophical writings on this, or virtually none. You could go back and look at what Aristotle said. You could look at what Thomas Aquinas said. You could look at what Descartes said, you know, but it was all pretty weak, really. They were all seemed like obviously rationalizations for what they wanted to do, namely, you know, continue to eat animals. And of course, some of those philosophers thought that you couldn't survive without eating animals. The only exception was Jeremy Bentham, who rather surprisingly, and I'd studied Bentham as a founding father of English utilitarianism, but I'd never come across a little footnote that he wrote in one of his works, which congratulates the French, this is just after the French Revolution, on recognizing that the color of a man's skin is no reason for denying them rights, and then goes on to say, maybe one day we'll recognize that whether a being has fur or a tail is also no reason for denying them rights.
At that time, did you identify as a utilitarian when you were reading Bentham?
Yes, I was already, by this stage, I was thinking of myself as a utilitarian, yeah. And Bentham goes on to say, and then he considers, you know, some people might say, well, we can reason or we have language. And Bentham says the question isn't whether they can reason or whether they can talk, but can they suffer? And that struck me as very persuasive. That, you know, it did seem to me that the capacity to suffer is what gives a being moral status. So then I started thinking about that and essentially thinking, you know, rethinking my views about the moral status of animals. And from that point on, a lot of the writings about human equality and human rights started to look different because they're all very positive when you think about, well, we want to give every human rights. We want a universal declaration of rights so that there are no more racist atrocities as like we've had in the past. But then you ask, well, but why is the boundary of this moral consideration the boundary of our species? What about beings who are capable of suffering but are not human? And there was just very, very little awareness even of the fact that in arguing for human rights as something specific to humans, there was a question that needed to be answered, and that is, why are human rights only for humans? Or why are rights or moral status or equal consideration of interests, why does that stop at the boundary of our species? So that was a conversation that got me thinking in a different direction, and eventually, a few years later, writing Animal Liberation.
It may seem insensitive, but I can't resist the thought, which hadn't occurred to me before, about a feedlot and a concentration camp and the amount of intense suffering, one being human, of course, and the other being non-human animals. There's something that came into my head, an image about the similarity between a feedlot and a concentration camp, which others may find insensitive.
Yeah, you're not the first to have that thought. One of the first is Jewish novelist Isaac Besheva Singer, who's no relation to me. He wrote a short story about someone who had been a slaughterman, and it has some lines like, it seemed to him that for the animals, all humans were like Nazis. And he uses the phrase something like, it's an eternal Treblinka. A lot of people can find it offensive, and I can easily understand why, but it's interesting that you know, one of the better known Jewish writers actually makes that point.
What came first, your writing on, I should know the dates, but Animal Liberation or your essay on morality and affluence? What was the order, and did one affect the other? I know the conversation you had with your Canadian friend or colleague was influential.
The order of publication is actually different from, I think, the order of influence. I focused on this meeting with Richard Keshen and the influence that it had on me. It wasn't that I wasn't interested in ethics, I was, but here was something that required me not just to take a theoretical interest, but to change the way I was living in quite a fundamental sense, because what you eat is very fundamental. You face choices about what to eat every day, more than once a day. And I should mention, I was already married by this time. I'd come to Oxford with my wife, Renata. We'd met as undergraduates at Melbourne University, so we got married quite young. And so, of course, you know, here I've met somebody who makes me think that maybe we should stop eating animals. And so I go and talk to Renata about it. She's quite sympathetic to that view. And she says, well, you know, yes, if you really think that this is wrong to do this. And we looked at Ruth Harrison's book together and so on. She said, you know, if you think that's wrong, then let's stop doing it. So here I'd made this important decision, which was going to change our lives because of deciding something is wrong. But there was something else that I had also latently, without really being very explicit about it, thought was wrong for some years. And that was the fact that here I was, as I said, by this stage, quite comfortably off. My father's coffee business was doing quite well. And there were these people in extreme poverty in parts of the world. And sometimes this came into the headlines. A couple of years before this, I don't remember the exact date, there'd been this terrible famine in Biafra, a region of Nigeria that was trying to secede from Nigeria. And there were horrible pictures of starving children. And then while I was in Oxford, and well, this wasn't before I met Richard Keshen, but it was within the next year, there was this terrible situation in what's now Bangladesh and was then East Pakistan, where a movement for autonomy broke out, and the Pakistani army repressed this very brutally, so brutally that 9 million Bengalis fled across the border to India. And so India suddenly had to cope with an influx of 9 million destitute refugees, and India was a much poorer country than it is now. So this was an enormous problem, and India appealed to Western nations for assistance and got some assistance, but it was pretty clearly not enough. There was this thing about, well, what should we be doing about this? What should Renata and I do? Should we be giving to Oxfam, say, which was happened to have its headquarters in Oxford? The name is an abbreviation of the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief, which was started after the Second World War. We talked to them, we went to see them and talked to them, and they were fairly convincing about both, you know, what the need for more aid and what they were doing about it. You know, so we talked about this too, and we decided that we should be doing something more substantial than we ever had been doing in terms of giving to charities to help people who were in whose lives were in peril because of their poverty. Around the same time that we stopped eating meat, or pretty soon after, we started giving 10% of our income to Oxfam, which wasn't a huge amount, but we didn't have a lot of money. Despite, as I said, my family being reasonably comfortable, we were not really getting financial assistance from them. And so I was on a scholarship. My wife had just started being a high school teacher in England. So we were okay, but that was something of a sacrifice, I suppose, a financial sacrifice anyway. But we started doing that, and then, as I say, the situation arose in East Pakistan or Bangladesh. And so I wrote this article, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, for a new philosophy journal called Philosophy and Public Affairs. It was actually published in the first volume in 1972. So in the order of publication, I wrote that article before I'd written anything about animals. The first piece I wrote about animals was a review article for the New York Review of Books in 1973. One of the reasons why I didn't write anything about animals sooner was that Richard introduced me to a couple of other friends, including another Canadian couple there called Stanley and Rosalind Godlevich. And they, together with an English student called John Harris, had edited an anthology of essays about the moral status of animals and our treatment of animals called Animals, Men, and Morals. But that anthology, when it was published in England, got no notice at all, really, anywhere in the English press. It was just ignored. And that was pretty typical of the attitude at the time, that issues about animals are just trivial. They're not important. They're sentimentality, things for animal lovers. Serious people focus on problems for humans, not on problems for animals. And that was very disappointing to, of course, you know, the Godleviches, and we're a little group, I suppose, a group of half a dozen or maybe 10 people in Oxford who were concerned about animals. Then the book that had been published in England was going to be published in the United States. And of course, the worry was that it would be ignored in the United States as it was ignored in England. I thought, can I do something to have it known, have it better known in the United States, get it covered in some way than it was in England? And the obvious place to do this then was the New York Review of Books, because that was the one journal or magazine that pretty much all progressives who, you know, fancied themselves as having some progressive ideas and interested in issues were going to read. It hadn't, as far as I know, ever covered anything about animals, but I thought maybe they would. They were open to various new ideas, you know, women's liberation, gay liberation, as well as a lot of stuff about the Vietnam War, of course. So I wrote to Robert Silvers, the editor, essentially saying why this book was important and saying, you know, this is really a manifesto for an animal liberation movement. I had no idea how he would respond, but I was very pleased that he responded by saying, well, this sounds like it could be interesting. No promises, of course, but if you'd like to send me something, I'll have a look at it. So I did that, and that led to my first article on animals, also called Animal Liberation, appearing in the New York Review of Books and attracting quite a bit of attention. That is, I got quite a lot of letters about it, some of them critical, but some of them very supportive. So that really was the order in which things developed. And the animal piece got more attention quickly, perhaps because it was in the New York Review of Books, and the Famine, Affluence, and Morality was in an academic philosophy journal. So it only gradually built up a significant readership, mostly because it started to be taught to philosophy classes. And so a lot of students got exposed to it. And that's why, in the end, it took many years, in the end, it had an influence on the effective altruism movement, because students had read it and started thinking about, well, is this right? Maybe it is right. Maybe we should be doing more for people in extreme poverty. But if we should, then we really need to do some research and find out what's the best thing to do, what's the most effective thing to do. And that's why, although I had not particularly emphasized effectiveness in that article, but I had emphasized the altruism aspect of it. That's why that article had an influence on the development of the effective altruism movement, which really only happened in the first decade of this century.
Hi, I'm Roy Head, the CEO of Development Media International. You're familiar with ads that sell products like shampoo and beer and medications. Well, we make ads too, but our radio and television actually save children's lives. They're scientifically evaluated and they're aired on radio stations in sub-Saharan Africa, encouraging mums to bring their young children and babies suffering from severe diarrhea or malaria or pneumonia for life-saving treatment in community health centres and hospitals. The Life You Can Save has been instrumental in raising funds to support our work. Please visit thelifeyoucansave.org/musings to find out how to save lives.
What led to your deciding to write a book called The Life You Can Save, which was similar to what you wrote in the Famine, Affluence, and Morality, but now had more emphasis on impact, cost right. effectiveness, and yeah. things like that?
After the New York Review of Books article, I then developed that, encouraged by some of the positive response I got, into the book Animal Liberation. So I had a book version of that idea, and I had a number of other books that I'd written about different topics. But I had never written a book on the question of what should we be doing to help people in extreme poverty. I'm not quite sure why I hadn't. I did have a chapter in my book, Practical Ethics, about that. Perhaps the time wasn't right for that. People didn't seem that interested in it. And other people had already written some things, clearly, you know, about global poverty. So what did I have that was particular to contribute? Then I came to the United States in 1999, when I was offered the chair of bioethics at Princeton University. And there was quite a lot of protest and controversy about my appointment at Princeton, most of it from the pro-life movement, most of it from people who knew about my views, not only about abortion, but also my support for euthanasia, voluntary euthanasia for people who were terminally ill and didn't want to go on living. Also in Australia, we had been consulted by directors of neonatal intensive care units about the treatment of infants born with severe disabilities. I'd written a book with an Australian colleague of mine called Should the Baby Live, in which we said that sometimes it was better that a baby born with severe disabilities not live, at least if that was what the parents thought was best for the child. And that although already doctors were implementing that desire that the child not live by withdrawing treatment and allowing the child to die because of the withdrawal of treatment, we thought that if it's sometimes justified to withdraw treatment, then it's sometimes justified to actively end the life of a child who was going to have, you know, really miserable prospects, perhaps was going to suffer for a year or two and die, or perhaps was not going to die so soon, but was never really going to have an independent life, or even perhaps not even recognize their mother or enjoy anything about their life. So because of my views on that, there was a lot of controversy about my appointment at Princeton. There were attempts to get it rescinded. And there was a front page article in the New York Times about the appointment. And that led an editor at the New York Times Sunday magazine to write to me and say, look, there's this controversy about your ideas. Would you like to write an article for us? It doesn't have to be about the euthanasia issue. It can be about anything you like. And so I decided to write something about global poverty and what we ought to do about it. These views that I'd held for many years. The Sunday Times published that, and they gave it the heading, it wasn't my heading, the Singer Solution to World Poverty. So that caused some more discussion. And then I don't remember exactly how this came about, but maybe it was something to do with some media coverage of Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation. I wrote another article for the New York Times Sunday magazine called What Should a Billionaire Give and What Should You Give? With that one, I think there was, again, a larger response. My agent, by this time I had a literary agent in New York, talked to me about writing a book on that topic. I had also been thinking that it was maybe time that I did write a book, that the time had come, that what Gates was doing and the attention that that had attracted had obviously given more prominence to the idea that maybe people ought to give a substantial part of their wealth, especially if they were really seriously wealthy, to help people in extreme poverty. I wrote that book. My agent sent it around to a number of publishers. We ended up with Random House, and that was published as The Life You Can Save in 2009. And of course, that was crucial for us meeting and getting together and founding the organization that has the same name.
I never asked you how strange it was when you got my initial email out of the blue of wanting to get together and help, and the subsequent conversations about starting an organization that would both promote your ideas and raise money for high impact nonprofits. Was it surprising to you?
Well, it was surprising because of who you were, right? Because you were someone who'd had a successful career in business and were basically offering to take a lot of time to, I think in your initial thing, you were still going to be part-time in the business, but...
I was consulting still for the business, but I had resigned as president to try to do something of social value other than selling suits.
Okay, so it was a little surprising. And I wasn't sure how genuine you were and, you know, whether you would get tired of this after a while. But I had been interested in trying to develop some sort of presence, you know, online for the ideas of the book.
And your friend in Poland had created a website, and Holly was marshaling some funds, I believe.
That's right. I had a friend in Poland who designed websites, who had designed a website for me. And the idea was that you could put up new items that were happening, talk about new charities that you'd come across that looked like they might be very effective. I should say, by the way, I was around this time, I had met Toby Ord, who was a graduate student then at Oxford, and Will McCaskill, who were talking about this new movement that they wanted to start. It wasn't yet called effective altruism. They wanted to promote the idea of how much good we can do by giving to the poor. And Toby had started an organization called Giving What We Can. There was a bit more, if you like, there was a revival of interest in this topic in those first decade of the century.
This is the follow-up question, and it's a little bit awkward. And I'm using myself as an example so you can speak to many people who are like me. You and I have started working closely together back in 2013 after we started this proper nonprofit, which now has raised maybe $100 million. We don't know exactly how much would have been raised without the organization because you were very influential on many, many people, including some billionaires. And certainly GiveWell has moved a lot more money than the life you can save. On the other hand, in 2019, we bought back the rights from Random House for your book. And now that book lives forever in being able to be distributed much more widely than Random House. So it's really hard to know what we've done together. But when Diane and I think about it back, we feel good about it. We could have done nothing, which we were doing pretty much before. So feels like a nice thing. But I wonder what it's like for you to work with someone like me or encounter people like me, and feel free to be as critical as you like, people who, I don't know, Diane and I will have given away about 25% of our net worth, but not more than that. We're not suffering. You know, you visited with us at our home and also on my son's farm. I still eat meat. I might be considered a reducitarian, but I eat meat. And I own two homes and I own two cars. And I wonder what it's like for you when you view people like that and how you view them and how you view yourself and your own ethical obligations, given at least my understanding of your life. And to me, it does have some ties to early influences, has been dedicated to reducing suffering in so many different places across species. So how do you view people who are only partially living an ethical life by the highest standards you set?
It's not as if I'm a saint, you know. It's not as if I'm in a position to say...
I was looking at your halo when I asked this question.
Right. You know, but I'm not in a position to say I'm living more than a partially ethical life. I think I'm also living a partially ethical life because I also have a life that is more comfortable than I need. You know, that's a compromise. I could be doing more, but I think it's difficult when, you know, I'm part of a family, obviously. Renata has her views. She's been tremendously supportive in what we've been doing, but maybe is still, not quite sure how to put it, is still more wanting to live a normal kind of life that people with our kind of income would live, and not just try to give away absolutely as much as we can down to our basic needs. So it's hard to, you know, say that I really know anybody who is completely pure in that. There's a book by Larissa McFarquhar called Strangers Drowning. I think the title actually refers to the example that I used in that original Famine, Affluence, and Morality article of saving a stranger, a child drowning in a shallow pond. But there are many examples in that book of people who are certainly closer to being completely dedicated and whatever it is. They're not all helping people in extreme poverty. One of the families I remember is adopting children in need with various disabilities or, you know, from broken homes. And I think they ended up at one stage having 23 children, adopted children.
One of our donors has 13 similar kind of donor to the life you can save.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we always make these compromises, and that's why I'm happy to work with you. I don't spend a lot of time thinking, oh, Charlie eats meat. That's really bad. You know, if you mention it, obviously I think of it, and I think it would be better if you didn't, especially. But I think you probably don't eat a lot of meat from factory farms, right? I know you have a son who's an organic farmer.
I'm not aware of eating meat from factory farms. I'm sure it happens.
That's an important step, because that seems to me to be the really horrible ways of treating animals, you know, where they just don't have good lives at all. And at least some of the other animals who are outdoors in the fields have plenty of good moments in their lives. I'm not the kind of person who's particularly, you know, censorious in terms of saying, you're not good enough. I don't want to work with you because of you're doing this or that. You know, there would be some people, and there would be some things, obviously, that would be true of. But somebody who's prepared to go quite a large distance in the right direction, whether it's in what they eat or in what they're giving, And certainly I know that you and Diana have given very substantially to The Life You Can Save and helped to build it up as an organization. And in addition to what you've given, I think that's been a key part of why we have been able to raise roughly estimated $100 million and pass it on to the most effective charities. And hopefully we'll do a lot more in future still. So, you know, I think you've had an enormous role in saving lives and reducing suffering for people in extreme poverty. So I'm certainly not going to look at the things that you might have done but didn't do and blame you for that.
There's always hope for the future too. I'm really grateful that you did want to work with me and that we have done this work together. And when I think back on what's the most impactful thing that I've been able to do in the last 10 years for The Life You Can Save and for people living in poverty, I think Dan Heath mentioned to me many years ago that maybe we should think about buying back the book, The Life You Can Save, from Random House. And I remember going to you and convincing you. It took a little bit of work.
I did take some convincing. Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And to me, that's an annuity. To me, this book now being able to give away for free on our website and many other ways, I think we know that the book influences very wealthy people as well as other people who are not wealthy. And I think the book living out there on our website and also if we can hack into other people's traffic that have millions of viewers, like Humanitex, for example, when they send out their newsletter, they have 2 million viewers, I think. So getting that content there is another way we can do it. So I feel like, yeah, the best thing that I feel like I've done for people living in extreme poverty is help facilitate the purchase of the book, The Life You Can Save, from Random House. And we're already seeing the results of that. We've talked rather abstractly about suffering. I actually think the story that you tell about your grandparents is both fascinating and so sad. There's lots we've talked about that I think is really interesting. I'd like to dive into something that might be more difficult to talk about but is current, which is how your philosophical views are affecting your view of what's going on in Palestine, Israel, Gaza. You've written about it. I've read about it. A lot of our listeners have not. Rather than just simply reviewing what you've written in those articles, I think it's important for you to talk about how the lens of utilitarianism might affect what you see in Gaza.
That's a difficult question because utilitarianism is concerned about acting so as to have the best consequences. And there are some cases where I think you can be fairly clear which of the choices open to you will have the best consequences. But it's much more difficult in a very complex situation like the Middle East, where some people may want to go back to the founding of Israel and ask whether that was a justifiable action, even though it was approved by the United Nations at the time. But you might want to say, well, the United Nations shouldn't have done that. They should have had more respect for the rights of Palestinians living there. That history is all tied up with that. But as a utilitarian, you really want to look at what is possible. And there are now 10 million Israelis living in the state of Israel. Even if you were to say that it was wrong to establish a Jewish state in Palestine, they are not going to leave. That's not a realistic option, any more than for that matter. And you might well say, and people can say, here am I in Australia, which was taken from indigenous people by the white settlers who came in 1788, I guess. We celebrate Australia Day as the day on which the first fleet, that is the first British fleet of British people coming to live in Australia, arrived. And a lot of people now refer to this as Invasion Day and say we should not celebrate it. But it's unrealistic, and I don't think anybody is actually saying that all non-Indigenous Australians should leave the country and hand it back to the whatever it might be, 500,000, perhaps people of Indigenous descent in Australia. That's not going to happen. And similarly, I can't see Israelis leaving. I can't see them even giving up the idea of a Jewish state, although personally, I don't support the idea of a Jewish state. I don't support the idea of a Islamic state or a Christian state or a Hindu state either. I support states that are secular and that respect people independently of their religion and give them equal rights and don't claim that that any one religion has priority in that state. So, you know, I can imagine a solution which would be not necessarily a two-state solution, but a multinational, multicultural, and multi-religious state in the area now occupied by Israel, or perhaps the area occupied by Israel and including the West Bank and Gaza. But given what's happened, including what happened on October the 7th, of course, but other things that happened before that, that just doesn't seem a realistic possibility now. That's what makes the situation so bad. And you have to think, well, how can the least harm be done? I think clearly Israel's continuing attacks on Gaza are causing immense harm. They've killed an estimated around 30,000 Gazans, many of them women and children. Some of them, of course, Hamas militants. I think that's an excessive reaction. I mean, let's be clear. Hamas started this war, right? The acts of October the 7th were absolute atrocities. When I was at Princeton, I watched a compilation of footage from body cameras that Hamas soldiers were wearing. They filmed themselves and dashboard cameras in their cars. And it's the most shocking thing I've ever seen. A lot of that footage has not been publicly available. I think it's perfectly clear that Hamas started this and that Hamas must have known that Israel would respond and respond with a lot of force and that would be terrible for Gazans. So I don't think Hamas is obviously trying to kill civilian Israelis, and I don't think it cares very much for the lives of civilian Gazans either. I think it's a bunch of religious fanatics who are prepared to murder for their goals.
My own opinion is they got the exact response from the Israelis that they were looking for, that they were trying to prevent peace in a multi-generational way, which they seem to have accomplished. I think my own lens now leads me to what to do now, because we do have these Palestinians who are saying they want to eliminate and wipe out Israel, and we have people in the Israeli government who seem to be believing the same thing about the Palestinians. Question is, what to do now? And I was interested in just focusing in on this narrow piece, although there is the much bigger picture, which I agree with you, seems not a tractable problem. How do you respond as Israelis or people outside of Israel to the fact that Hamas committed these atrocities, tremendous, horrible atrocities, which were intended to have this bad consequence? But what to do now, and whether seeing it from your own lens helps you understand what the best way to proceed is in this very specific instance?
I think that it's still very difficult. I think even if you say, look, we're just looking forward within this limited situation, it's very difficult because there are now extremists on both sides. You know, Hamas is certainly extremists and probably don't have majority support among Gazans, probably didn't have even previously. They certainly didn't hold elections. We have the most extreme nationalist government that Israel has ever had. I hope possibly some pressure on the Israeli government can lead it to try to stop the fighting, try to find a way to allow Gazans to return to a somewhat normal life. Certainly they should be providing them with the necessities of life. There's a lot of hunger in Gaza now. There's almost no proper health care. There's a lot of shortages. So I think those things need to be provided. If there is some way of disempowering Hamas, you know, maybe they're not going to get entirely rid of Hamas, but of disempowering it and making it much more difficult for them to do the kinds of things that they were doing on October 7th, then that might be the best that can be achieved in this pretty terrible situation.
My last question on this, and then I want to ask before we end a question about what people might not know about Peter Singer that they would be surprised to hear, things about you that you do or think about. But my last question is, you know, it almost comes to me almost when you think about the hostages and what you do to save the hostages, that's how narrow my lens is getting now. I think, well, how many Gazans do you displace or kill in order to save X number of hostages? It almost becomes, and this sounds very crude, like a trolley problem that you get when you read some of the work of people who write from a perspective in which they're interested in resolving these kinds of issues. Is it fair to think that the hostage problem can be posed as how many people in Gaza do you kill or displace because of what Hamas did or because you're trying to retrieve hostages?
One of the ways in which you can certainly object to what the Israeli government has been doing in Gaza is that it is a disproportionate response in terms of, say, the number of Gazan civilians who are being killed as compared to the number of hostages that might be rescued, or for that matter, even in terms of killing the Hamas militants. There was an example not that long ago when the Israelis managed to free two hostages, but I think they killed over 100 Palestinians, Gazans. Now, some of those no doubt were militants, but I think a lot of them were not. And, you know, whatever the numbers were, let's say even it was only 50 and the other 50 were militants, which I think is very unlikely. To kill 50 civilians in order to free two Israeli civilians doesn't seem to me defensible.
All right. Well, from this somber topic, but we've talked a lot about suffering, which is what I think is appropriate when I'm discussing things with Peter Singer. I'd like to ask you, what are two things that people might not know about you that are part of your life, that are a big part of your life? It's almost a rhetorical question because I think I know some of those things, but something I'd like to bring out to the audience.
Okay, so one possibility is that I'm a surfer. I came fairly late to surfing, that is surfing in the sense of riding a board, but I've always lived near the ocean. Australian cities are mostly by the ocean, and I've always loved being in the waves, whether it was body surfing or just using a boogie board. And I sort of was persuaded to take up a board when I thought it was really too late. I was already in my 50s by meeting somebody who was a surfing legend in Australia. It was a result of going to a writers' festival at a place called Byron Bay and meeting a guy called Rusty Miller, who was actually originally an American and was the 1961 maybe national surfing champion of the United States, something like that. Well, maybe it was later in the 60s. He's 80 now, so he's a little bit older than me, and he's still surfing. He said, no, it's not too late to learn. I can teach you, and he did. So I enjoy that, and I'm really pleased. It's summer here, of course, in Australia, and I was riding a wave just 2 days ago. So it's great to still be able to do that. That's one thing people may not know about me. The other thing that I enjoy doing is I'm a bit of a forager. I forage anything basically edible that I find, but the thing that I most enjoy is mushrooms. And of course, you need to know your mushrooms. But I've had a lot of fun with that, particularly actually when I went to Princeton, because there's a mushroom that we don't get in Australia called hen of the woods, which is a beautiful mushroom, quite large, and relatively easy to find during the season, which is usually October or early November. You know, I found wonderful mushrooms around the Princeton campus and in New York Central Park. Quite surprising what you can find in places that are visited by thousands of people and they don't know that they're looking at a mushroom, which, as I say, these are quite large, and each mushroom might weigh 3 or 4 pounds, and you can see these for sale at like $20 a pound. So people are just walking past these things.
I think most of us are scared of mushrooms, and you're right. We just look right past them. I know that what midnight one night I was in a bar with Peter Singer looking at an Australian rules football game that was a final between his team and another team. I think it was the Melbourne team, one of the Melbourne teams against the Perth team, as I remember.
Yeah, it was the Hawthorn was the team I was supporting, and it was the West Coast Eagles we were playing.
So Peter not only introduced me to suffering in extreme poverty, which of course I knew something about, but he got me inspired to do something about it, but also Australian rules football, although I've never been able to catch on to cricket at all, even though Peter tells me that I could. I seem to be unable to learn the rules. Stacey Black, our marketing director, also tries to get me to learn cricket, but I'm not. But I am really grateful to you, Peter, for having this tremendous impact on my life, on Diana's life, and helping us join you just a little bit in the work that you've done to help people living in poverty. And now, as I turn the organization over to new executive directors, Andre and Jessica LaMesa, I'm particularly excited about the definition of poverty from a multidimensional point of view. We've always looked at it as a number of people living under a certain dollar amount, like $2.15, but we're now trying to look at poverty in a multidimensional way in terms of health, education, and living standards, and the life you can save as an organization under new leadership, although Peter and I will continue to be board members and very involved, will now be able to grow the number of nonprofits that we can identify through our research team and support. And I think we will offer an adjunct, I don't know what the right word, to GiveWell and other organizations that use different approaches. And Peter once told me when I was talking about differences between groups, Peter said, I remember quoting Mao and saying, why don't you let 1,000 flowers bloom? And I think the Life You Can Save will be an organization that will be broad in its approach, but still focus on cost effectiveness and impact. And other organizations like GiveWell and the Founders Pledge and many others will focus in a different way. And in aggregate, we will try to work as hard as we can to reduce human suffering. And Animal Charity Evaluators and others will be working on trying to reduce non-human animal suffering. Anyway, Peter, I'm really grateful that you've allowed me to become a part of that. And thank you also for being on the podcast today.
Well, thank you, Charlie. And of course, I'm very grateful that you did write me that email long ago and that you more than lived up to what you promised in the email, that you've put a lot of work and money into building an effective organization that has really done well. So thanks very much. And it's also been my pleasure to talk to you on this podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Musings About Ourselves and Other Strangers. Subscribe and join us. Our guests have varied experiences, different points of view, and interesting ideas about what it means to live a well-balanced moral life. We hope you'll share this podcast with those close to you. We'd also like to invite you to rate and review this podcast on whatever platform you use. And if you're interested in learning more about The Life You Can Save and the charities we benefit, visit thelifeyoucansave.org/musings.